So we spent the day together yesterday really inviting ourselves to come closer to be in contact with some of the elements of what we understand by or recognize as the implications of death. Contemplating this fundamental element of our life or our experience. It's interesting in sort of conventional thinking, sometimes life and death are suggested to be kind of sort of paired opposites. In terms of the Dharma teachings, we don't see it in those terms, and we see birth and death as being, in a way, the paired opposites, the arising of and the solution of experience of body, of forms, of each moment. And that life is the framework in which that takes place, we could say. So I'm just curious in terms of, we've been reflecting and talking particularly on the letting ourselves yesterday, letting ourselves really come in contact with what that means for us, that having been born, this body will die. That having come together in the particular shape of this personality or this individuality, in however way we conceive it or understand it, and our relationships with other people, personalities, individualities, we could say, and equally situations and things, that this is for some time, but not forever. And it's unknown to us when that time will be complete. It can't be known to us, it seems, for the most part, at least not until it's imminent. I'm just kind of curious, again, if any of you have any experience or something you might like to share from having been here through the day and then going home or back to wherever you were in the evening, through the morning. Did you notice something staying with you? Did it disappear as soon as you walked out of the room and, planning for dinner and whatever else one needed to take care of that evening became what was there? Did you notice any effect in how you woke up in the morning with what you were with? And I'm not saying that there should have been. It's absolutely fine if that wasn't the case. But I'm just curious if, again, from any of you, there's something you noticed or that stood out for you. In the sense, it might have been even just the interest and looking forward to coming back, or the sense of, oh my gosh, I know, I'm not sure I want to, and yet you're here anyway. There's something I think very wonderful and remarkable and in a sense almost unexpected that people would be wanting to do something like this, to choose to come along and do this, and of course many good reasons for it, and yet not to take for granted there's something remarkable about that intention and motivation. So all of that's in there, and I'm not looking for anything here. I'm just, again, interested to hear and see if there's anything.
I spent a lot of time yesterday. The content and process was fine, but the context for me personally was perhaps different to most people, because I've been close to death a lot in my life. 40 years of nursing, etc. I've actually been touching people dying, touching people dead, and being close to myself and things. So I was left with a feeling that I developed a feeling that life is an adventure. Since by the age of 3, I'd be going out into an adventure. So where I've been left with, and where I was left after yesterday, is the feeling, am I going towards something, or am I going away from something?
Mm. Mm.
In the last 4 or 5 years, I've learned a bit about my own narcissism and ego and all those sorts of things, so I'm getting to grips with those as best I can. I'm still left with me seeing life to do with action and going out. Mm-hmm. And I see death in the same way. Death is another adventure.
Right.
I don't have any fears that I can't remember how you feel.
Okay, so the people here all right? Yeah. I think it's great to notice that sense of how we relate in terms of moving towards or going towards or moving away from. And that to have an interest and an openness to the question, is my sense of it's an adventure or relative ease with relating to it, is that in some way an avoidance or a not quite letting myself be touched? And not assuming it is or it isn't, but just letting the question be open and seeing how, from the point of view of ourself, the personality, we can only really meaningfully relate in terms of that towards and away from. It doesn't quite make sense to relate in other ways, because the story of me is of having come from and going towards any number of things. And sometimes just the fact that that starts to stand out to be seen. Oh. And what I hear a little bit in what you're saying is also just a little bit not taken for granted as the only way to reference what's happening. Huh? And there's something very powerful in that. Just opening up a little bit of a question there. Or maybe it's not just a little question. Maybe it's something a bit larger by way of a question of, oh, okay. Maybe this isn't about going towards or away from. Although, certainly the body is heading, as we say, in that direction. So just to, I think, stay with the question that you have there. It sounds useful. Not assuming an answer. Not assuming there's something out of order in the location you find yourself in. At all. I think sometimes there's ease, sometimes there's a sense of being challenged by, sometimes it's just where we are. We're not trying to get ourselves into a particular place yet with regard to this. Thank you. Yeah,
I noticed that. I noticed I had a lot of joy when I was thinking about coming back, which is kind of interesting for some friends, I guess, you know, but I having sat this once before with you, I found the alteration of my perspective, you know, because I realised that it creates meaning for me to look at this. But something that I did notice was in looking at death and life and death and experience and ageing in this way, that I've been working a lot with just being able to look at my fear and in layers over recently with my practice and noticing the basic existential fear, which is kind of natural and there, you know, that as a human I'm going to want to survive, you know, life wants to live. But the change in perspective was interesting and noticeable to me in the minutiae of my day-to-day fears, that the perspective has really quite altered in the experience of spending some time in this contemplation. So, because, you know, the what's going to happen with that job is really pretty, is really of not any importance when I spend a little bit of time in this contemplation, I notice.
Right, great. So that, it's kind of like we see how the fear and anxiety we might have or stress and pressure around things in some way is connected to our survival.
Yeah.
Or we believe it is, and sometimes it actually genuinely is at a certain level, but often it's not as connected as we imagine or fear, as the fear seems to say to us. Mm. And actually being able to locate the territory of one's survival or what's really important clearly in one place actually releases it from other places. Other things settle. And it's interesting just to see how that happens. Even, as you say, having kind of done the contemplation before, it's not like we're done with the contemplation. It's like something, oh, I've done that. And, you know, okay, it's more like, oh yeah, we can come back to this, and we can come back to this, and come back to this. And again, you know, as the Buddha said, for frequent recollection, or daily recollection. And it actually makes a difference.
It really opens life up, I find, because the horizon, when we get so involved, you know, the vision closes down, life closes down, but in opening these explorations up, I find it really opens life to a much wider experience.
Right, and so again, then, as you said, you know, joy can arise because it's a natural expression of that openness, seems to me. There's a natural expression of openness that is alive, and joy being an expression or a way we understand, we experience that. And it's so counterintuitive. It's so not what we think. That there's so much, in a way, dampening down of that vitality and aliveness by not letting the full truth of death be known, be felt, be talked about with our friends and whatever else. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
Often more than death is actually what it is to be alive. When you look at someone who is dead, whether that's a person or an animal, whatever, and especially if you've seen them a minute ago was alive, now, you know, like my cat or whatever, now it's dead, and the personality is gone, and it just seems it's just machines, and when the machine doesn't work anymore, everything is gone. On the other hand, when I look at a seed, and like an avocado seed or a bean or whatever, which doesn't seem much alive, now you put it somewhere in the earth, and then all of a sudden it starts sprouting. I think, where does that come from, that
right.
life?
Right.
So there must be something more than that. You know, there's like a contradiction.
Right, yes, beautiful. And so, again, they're the people here are right. That sense of that reflecting or contemplating on this topic is actually part of bringing ourselves into contact with the sense of what is it that's alive? What is it that we're conceiving or believing will be lost in what we call death? And, you know, that death and birth, in a sense, come together. That we can look at the death side of it. Well, what's gone from that which was animated? When suddenly it's not in that moment. If we're there in that moment, and actually the whole thing is still there, except it's not. And it's usually a bit more gradual in the birth thing. I mean, obviously, a creature being born, whether it be a child or some other creature, the birth happens in a moment, or maybe a few moments, depending how that goes. But the process of it seems more gradual, and yet it's also equally miraculous, remarkable, and just how did this material, inanimate, so we think or say, come to be alive? And to allow oneself to be a little perplexed or confounded, or, you know, in a way, it takes us a little bit out of the mind that thinks it knows how things are. Because actually our mind can't really comprehend that. It can be wonderfully mystified by it. And there's an opening in that mystification, or kind of not, it's different than confusion, because we're not assuming we should know, I would say. So to let oneself, oh, you know, what is it to be alive? What is this? Do we so take, you know, it's so much the central thing of it, everything, and yet we don't really necessarily become curious about it. We might, but we don't necessarily without some support or encouragement. Become curious about, so what is it to be alive? Because this is the question that actually is very much at the heart of the resolution to what death means in the midst of life. So again, I'm happy and interested to hear that reflection coming out of what we've been exploring.
I find that I've always been obsessed with death since a child. Because I grew up in a place where you see dead animals everywhere. And it wasn't an organized, it's the favorite interest. It's a little island called Mauritius. And this is quite a few years back. Until recently, I've been a great reader of biographies. autobiographies. When I pick up a biography, I want to know how the guy died. And I have a friend, we've known each other for many years. She said she flatlined and she had one of these out-of-body experiences. She says to me, "You don't understand, I'm fearless of death because I have died." I said, "You haven't died because you're talking to me." I said, "You may have been on the threshold or something." And this morning I've been going to, you know, listening to teachers like yourself on Guy House in France. Why? And for 11 years, you know, and I've done certain other things before. I think what I'm reminded here is the urgency of the moment. And I hear all of you talking about death, by the way. You know, I thought of all the teachers that I've heard from Guy House. Death. Well, there's three things: sense of wonderment, death, and the urgency of the moment. So when I hear somebody saying, "I'm not frightened of death," I can say this. I can actually say this. I can say, "I am not frightened of death." But why do I keep asking this question? Why is he coming back to people like you? It must be. I think there's two things going on here. You know, there's knowing and really knowing.
Yeah.
Because I think, to me, the person who really understands what death is happening is the people now in intensive care, who actually know that there's no way out. This is it. But I feel I'm not frightened of death. I'm not frightened of death. It's strange what I'm trying to say.
No, I don't think it's strange. I think it's actually, you know, the fear of death is to a large extent arising out of it not having been attended to, not being examined, not being looked at. It's like, so long as we don't look at it, there's the kind of idea somehow persistent in the mind that it could be avoided, and therefore there's the struggle to avoid it, which is what fear is about. Fear is this momentum to try and avoid something which is avoidable. It doesn't make sense trying to avoid something that's not avoidable. We don't, you know, it just doesn't happen in the same way. So that's part of the power of really contemplating and, in a sense, confronting that tendency, is to say, oh, if this isn't avoidable, then actually, oh, okay, well, you know, there's a certain way in which our intelligence recognizes when we let it be in contact with that, that, oh, okay, so it's not avoidable. So it's no point trying to spend my life avoiding it coming to an end. And that, at the same time, doesn't mean that this isn't profoundly interesting, remarkable. How can there be something and then nothing? You know, something and then nothing. How can that be? What does that tell me about my idea of something and nothing? They are just ideas, actually. Existence, non-existence, they're just ideas in the end. And that sense of we can know and yet have the honesty and the humility and the courage to recognize that we don't yet know all there is to know. In one sense, we can't know until we're there. And we don't know if when we're there we'll be in any state in which we can know. We can't. I remember being very struck by, and you talk about being in intensive care or times of real challenge and difficulty, that we know what that is, even if it's not quite death, if we see that's where it's going. I remember hearing about this exchange between Ajahn Chah, who I mentioned yesterday, a teacher from Thailand, and Jack Kornfield, who was a student of his for a while, and spent time with him in Thailand. And Jack is, maybe some, probably most of you know, is a sort of senior teacher in this insight meditation tradition from California. And Jack came to see Ajahn Chah when Ajahn was really ill, and he spent the last few years of his life in a coma after a surgery that I'm not sure if it didn't go well or what happened. But not long before that, he was in very difficult condition and looking like he was going to die. And he was, as a teacher, a very challenging, also very humorous, and I find him remarkably inspiring and simple and direct. But he would often, when someone was struggling with something or suffering in some way, he'd say, are you suffering? You know, if they were telling about somebody, are you suffering? And he'd say, oh, you must be attached then. And kind of giving this message of, oh, it's when we get attached that we suffer. You know, understanding that as the suffering born of struggling with the way things are, rather than the underlying difficulty of things that are difficult. Yeah? And so Jack asked him how he was. And he said, oh, it's really, you know, he said, you know, are you suffering? And I turned to him and said, yeah. And Jack's response was, well, you must be attached. You know, and I can just see Jack's face. I wasn't there, obviously, but I can just imagine knowing Jack. He's a bit of a, sort of a joker, if that's the right word. Sort of a mischievous is the word. And the story, as I heard it, that Ajahn Chah looks at him and says, deadly serious, no mirth here. He says, you have no idea. And just something about that, okay, yeah, until we've actually been to those places, and maybe amongst us we have, I'm not saying people here haven't, but until we've been to those places, we don't know. We don't know what it will be like. We don't know. I remember being ill in India and carried like a sack of potatoes by someone who I hardly knew to a hospital and, in a way, you know, dumped there. I couldn't really move. And at a certain point, they, having done various tests, came and told me, okay, we think you've got hepatitis and maybe malaria as well. And there was this moment in that where I thought it was just like this fear and terror. I'm going to die. That's it. I'm this ill. I'm that bad. This is a horrendous situation. But that would be more words than I am. Just like, I'm going to die. Now, I didn't, obviously. I was fortunate. There was good care in the hospital. But we don't know what we'll be like in a place like that when we face whatever we may have to face in our lives. And so some real humility in that, and that willingness, as you say, to, okay, maybe I have something more here to learn. It doesn't discount what we have learned, but there's more to learn. There's more to learn.
There is something that I regret to this day, having said to my mother when she was dying, you know, and it meant a good idea at the time, you know, in a way to console her, because she was in a lot of pain. She was dying of pancreatic cancer. As in 1989, they did quite a bit with palliative medicine. And, and I said, Mama, I know what you're going through. And she looked at me and she said, you don't know what I'm going through. I've always regretted that. But at the time, it was the most consoling thing I could say.
Yeah. And, you know, there are reasons why we might wish to express our empathy, even though, of course, it has its limits and truth as to how much we could really know that. But
it's a good lesson in teaching. It was a lost teaching for me.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe the roles weren't entirely just of what you could offer her, but what she could still offer you at that point. Yeah. To bring some resolution and just to see, it's a quite. I noticed the same. I remember feeling like, oh, there's one or two things where I realised I'd be sad if I didn't get to go back to that person or didn't get to try and adjust something in the situation. Whether I can or not, I don't know, but I would be sad if it stopped here. So that sense of there's the motivation to, okay, that might not be clear or easy to me how to do it, but I'd like to see if I can try and find a way. Yeah. And there's something that can be, I think, again, just allowing ourselves to feel the tender place of the imperfection of things. That we can often kind of, and I can notice myself living sometimes a little bit with the fantasy of, I'll get round to resolving that, or that'll find its way to a nice conclusion, or a a sort of a healing or resolution. And there isn't a guarantee it will. But the sense of feeling and giving some support to the wish, so far as I can, for that to be possible. Yeah. The only rational act of a lifetime.
Yeah, and about things that were important to me, yeah, with relationships too. So, yeah, and it was, and that, so, but the kind of joy, the sort of relaxed, like, free acceptance of kind of what was happening, not feeling sort of anxiety, maybe. That's not something.
So we could also see that the different experience changes with that, and yet some, again, that sense of feeling more at ease or open with things that may not be ideal the way as we wish them. And I think it's kind of like if things somehow land, and that changes, but then again we're, you know, re-entering the territory and see where we go. Yeah, good, thank you. Nana, please, yeah.
I found myself feeling quite overwhelmed with different emotions, really. Anger, pain, like you mentioned yesterday, anger being anger masking pain. So I'm really realizing that. I also felt a lot of responsibility coming with that fact that we need to. I'm sorry, I'm pretty confused.
It's okay, you're doing fine.
I just feel a lot of pressure when it comes to, oh, we have to live our lives, you know, to the fullest, and this urgency of now, as gentleman spoke about. I feel a lot of pressure that I need to do something. Mm-hmm.
So just what I would suggest you do with that, it's the tendency for the feeling of urgency is to kind of go into I have to do something, because that's what we tend to make of the feeling. But see if you can let yourself just experience the energy in the urgency without assuming that it means something's wrong or something needs to be different, but actually just making space for the energy itself. Because it's true that part of this contemplation reflection is it does sometimes release energy in the form of a sense of urgency. But what we might do with urgency is kind of look towards somewhere else, as in towards the future, what I need to get done before, rather than where it's more useful, which is actually, okay, what's needed right now? And with the urgency, what's needed right now is actually just to experience it. Don't assume you have to do something with it. But let yourself feel what's in it. Just that you noticed there that there was some pain. That there was maybe some anger. Which, you know, if we look at it as in a wholesome way, anger is often about the energy to try and address something. Now, sometimes it's things we can't do anything about, in which case it's not so helpful. But sometimes it's about having courage to stand in a place where we need to say no to something that's not okay. Or we need to say, okay, I'm going to make a change here, even though it's going to be difficult and scary and I'm not sure what the heck is going to happen when I try and do this. Yeah? So again, the energy mobilizing to let it actually find its way rather than assume I have to make this happen. Although it's not going to be happening without you. Yeah, in that sense. It's like, but letting yourself really just feel it. Is it there for you right now?
Are you actually reading my mind? Because I've been struggling with that energy. Mm. And there were a lot of images coming to my mind that I need to assert myself. Mm. Life is too short to be, you know, a doormat.
Okay. So just let yourself feel what that's like, even just as you name it. Okay, so we might see that often it's actually fear that stops us from fully expressing what we love, believe in, or feel is important about ourselves or our lives. And holding that fear in the light of death, we see actually, no, it's more scary to not do it. Or it would be a greater loss or harm or grief to not actually find a way to express it. So to begin with, letting yourself just feel the sorrow, distress, or pain of finding it hard to do that. And with compassion for oneself. And then to see, okay, what's this calling here? What's it asking for? What might be possible? But go slowly with it. First thing is really let the energy have its expression in your experience. And see what it suggests to you. So I think I'd like to just continue and offer some further sort of material in the territory. So one of the things we see when we reflect on, when we contemplate on this topic, on this territory, is that what we're pointing to, and this is coming out quite clearly in some of what's being shared, is that when we reflect on death, when we contemplate death in this way, there's a process that happens for us where we start to see that the concept is a reference point for something that doesn't have a reference point. If you follow, it's like we don't quite know what it is that we're talking about when we're talking about death. And so what it actually is representing for us is that place where we don't know what or who we will be, or what or how this experience will be, in that it will be or it won't be even. We don't know. That experiencing will continue. And so almost all the things we fear in some way come back to this sense of death, the sense of not being here or not knowing what it will be to be what we are or how we are or where we are. And so if we look at things we're afraid of, often there's a sense of this happens and then there's just the fear. But actually, if we actually let ourselves sit with and think, okay, I'm afraid, say, about financial material resources and the culture and circumstance of our world, there can be a lot of fear around that. Like, if I don't have enough. And I've kind of reflected and played this, and I see what it actually is like if I don't have enough. In fact, actually, we can take it back one step. Getting a good night's sleep, okay? Getting a good night's sleep can be a bit stressful. If I don't get a good night's sleep, I'm not going to function very well the next day. If I don't function very well the next day, maybe I'm going to mess up in what I do. Yeah? And if I mess up in what I do, maybe I'm not going to be able to sustain my livelihood. And if I don't sustain my livelihood, I'm going to be homeless and destitute, living on the street. And if I'm homeless and destitute and living on the street, I'm going to die. And it's like, I'm scared about a good night's sleep because it's potentially going to be my death. And one can actually see that most of the last six steps there, one doesn't actually let oneself think. It's just, but they're in there. If we actually sit, and that's something I've done with this and watched and seen, oh, that's where it goes. That's where it goes. And it's like, okay, and of course, different people will have different things. It may not be that. But I thought, oh, okay. Oh, okay, so this isn't actually going there. But that sense of being able to name that, oh, this is about fear, is inevitably about death, we start to come into the possibility of just seeing that what it brings us back to, if I don't know what's next or what's going to happen, it's the unknown. Death is really a word for the unknown. We don't know what it will be. We don't know how it will be. And the only death we can really meaningfully engage with is entering into the unknown. Entering into the conditional state of, we don't know how it will be. We actually don't know how it will be in the next moment. We don't know how it will be at the end of today. And we can't, because we don't even know if we will for sure be here at the end of today. And that's, to a large extent, why we don't like to go there. I mean, yeah, we like to go there in one sense. We're inviting ourselves, we're bringing ourselves here. But at some level, something doesn't want to, because of that. And I touched on this yesterday, but the way in which we kind of tend to come to positions about what death is or isn't. Now, the death is nothing to be concerned about, because we'll get reborn, or we'll go to heaven, or whatever. Or those who die, who we lose, will be reborn, and we don't have to worry about them, or they'll go to heaven and, you know, get to sort of look down on us benevolently. That there's a kind of a consolation for us in that, that takes us from the unknownness to a there's a known for us. And equally, the idea that somehow life is annihilated at death and it stops, and there's just nothing that has any relationship to this life unfolding that goes beyond that point of the body's death, equally a consolation. It's like, as I think this, again, it was mentioned yesterday, just, oh, sure, yeah, huh, you know, the sense of stopping. And so the Buddha talked about, in terms of basic tendencies of craving, the craving and desire for sense experiences, the kind of more obvious and common one that we're in touch with. We want this kind of experience, we don't want that kind of experience. But together with, and in a certain way underneath that, is what we make of those experiences. And the two kinds of craving, or the other two, so of the three kinds of craving the Buddha points to, it's the craving for existence, bhava, tanha, and the craving for non-existence, vibhava, tanha. Tanha is craving, bhava, existence. And so it's, oh yeah, that movement to, oh, there will be something after this. In a certain way, that's, if we're orienting towards existence, wanting that sense of existence, then that's a relief. If the idea is, if we're not, then something after this is, oh no, coming back again, you know. And the reverse, of course, for if we really want to come back and there's the thought of we're not, that's scary. But if we don't want to exist, if there's actually some attachment to the idea of non-existence, then, oh, what a relief, I get to not exist. Yeah? And those tendencies are always centering around the sense of self. So, both rebirth and annihilation are uncertain, unknown, unfixable as outcomes here. And so, part of what is needed is really the way in which we enter into that sense of loss, not just of what we're close to and care about, but also the sense of certainty and security and kind of somehow having a place to orient around in terms of self. Because that's what death takes away. That there isn't a place to orient around in that way. And part of what I think is, I'm not sure if inevitably necessary, but certainly for many, an important part of that journey or the encounter in this territory is is really actually opening ourselves to the grief and to the loss that is involved in this existence that is not forever. You know, the Buddha spoke about this as one of the facets of human existence, of loss, of grief, of the ending of things that impacts in our heart. And this is unavoidable. To enter into birth, there must be death. Whatever is born will die. This we see very clearly. This we see, this body born, it will die. Relationships arising will come to an end. Contact with situations or things. This green, blue planet, likewise, its existence is not forever. Its sustainability in its current form is perhaps more temporary than we've allowed ourselves to believe. And we see the vulnerability, and we might feel it in the sorrow or loss of a dear and beloved friend or family member or partner. We might feel it in, you know, hearing the news of, and you know, and if one follows such things, or just seeing what's happening environmentally in this world at the moment, and the devastation, the destruction, and the potential for further and immense accelerating loss of not just individual beings, but actually even species and habitats. And the grief and the anger equally we might feel about how that's happening is part of what's there. But actually letting oneself come to those places, not as a way of kind of somehow entering into a misery relationship with things, of kind of, oh, that's horrible, even though it's something that is tragic and deeply painful. So we could say horrific in terms of how it impacts our hearts. To actually let ourselves feel that. It's the resistance that actually makes it horrific. The feeling itself is just that it opens us, ultimately. And, you know, I find it striking and powerful for myself to just reflect on and bring to mind stories and situations. And you may have them in your own lives. And I'm very aware of this when I come and sit and speak in a group like this, of people maybe who you are close to and with, who maybe are recently or close to death, recently dying, dead or close to death. And there can be a lot there for us that, you know, again, we tidy it up kind of quickly. So many people have lost someone. I hear, and speaking with them, the sense of pressure from others or from themselves to kind of get past it, get, you know, put it down, get on with your life. Get on with your life. Actually, sometimes that grief, that sorrow, that is one's life in this place. One's life isn't something waiting at the other end of it. That is something. It has its place. And to actually reflect on such stories, such situations where, for me, I find myself touched to hear of such things. A story I was reading recently that kind of had a resonance for me personally in a certain way. It was a story of a New Zealand climber and Himalayan guide whose name was Rob Hall. I didn't know him. I guess you know him from, did I say I'm from New Zealand? Anyway, I've spent some time in the mountains and time in the Himalaya. They're not climbing the Himalayas, just more trekking in the area. But there's this story of a guy who, at the time this happened, I guess was not so different in age than myself. And he'd made this guy, Rob Hall, he'd made his fifth successful summit of Everest in May 1996. It's a record for anyone who isn't a Sherpa. So any non-native to that region to have got to the top of Everest five times. And he was trying to get a group of weak and stranded climbers off the south summit when a storm came in. And one of the climbers was too weak to continue. It was one of his clients. American man by the name of Doug Hansen. And so he stayed with him up in the mountain. He could have climbed down by himself and got out, but he chose not to, because this was someone he'd taken up to the top. And he said, or his intention was clearly, I'll stay with this person. I'll help him get down. And they were without tent, without oxygen, without sleeping bags, on a mountain 8,000 meters up. And they bivouacked together, which means they basically dug a hole in the snow and crawled into it, because that's the most protection you can get in that environment. And his client died in the night. He stayed alive for another day and a half up there. And he'd been out of oxygen, exposed to the elements for 2 days in a blizzard. And he had a radio. He was up there. He was in contact with his camp, base camp. And they were able to connect them to his wife in New Zealand. And so it's really interesting. I don't know how it is that I can read this. I've read this so many times. I've shared this kind of story with people like yourselves before. And when I just listen to them, just feel, oh gosh, actually, you know, in some way this is all of our story, but this is very particular. That he'd chosen to stay there. And with his strength failing, he asked the people of base camp to put him through to his wife, Jan, in Christchurch, was the city I grew up in, or near, who was 7 months pregnant at the time. And he said, "Hi, my sweetheart." She tried to comfort him, and his last words were, "I love you. Sleep well, my sweetheart. Please don't worry too much." And what else to say? So, what I notice in just allowing myself and this inviting you to just hear that, and it may have different response from you. I'm always in a certain way surprised that it has the same response in me. It's not always the same, but that it touches me. It's like, oh gosh, what is it to meet and to sit and to be with someone one loves in that moment? That hasn't happened to me like that in my life. It may have been part of your lives with friends or family near to death. And yet something about that closeness that one could speak, and yet the distance that he was, as his wife later related, she said, you know, he sounded like Major Tom from David Bowie's Space Oddity, you know, like he was floating away. And they talked about the impossibility of being rescued from the summit ridge before. They knew that was one of the risks he took in doing it. And he had actually put it, she said, "You might as well be on the moon." And so someone who chose to stay in a situation like that, to support somebody else when he could have saved himself. And in that, he lost his wife, an unborn child. His wife and unborn child lost him, I guess one should say. And what's it like for us if we let ourselves just contemplate and reflect on that? It's like, oh gosh, that's deeply painful. It's deeply painful. I think I shared the story the last time I was teaching in London on this topic a couple of years ago, which also struck me in this way of a young man, a teenager, in the UK somewhere, it was just 2 or 3 years ago it happened, who got his foot caught somehow in a train track. And he could hear a train coming. He couldn't get his foot out. He's got a mobile phone, we all do, don't we? He calls his dad and says, "Dad, help." And I just think about what that was. They probably couldn't hang up. They probably were both there. His dad is saying, "I'm coming." His son is saying, "Help." He died. His father couldn't get there. He couldn't get off the track. The train hits him. He's dead. And it's like, you know, these aren't such rare things in the world, these kinds of situations, stories. I mean, but sometimes it seems the poignancy of letting ourselves be touched by the actual knowing that it's happening, as it's happening, That's some of it. And what that does for us, or to us, in us, is, I find, something important to let oneself be open to. To let oneself be open to. Because we have to let go. And letting go, yeah, we don't know what that's going to be like. We don't want to kid ourselves that it's going to be easy because we've been practicing. I think that's a really important thing. So Mary Oliver, again, she writes in Blackwater Woods, "Look, the trees are turning their own bodies into pillars of light, are giving off the rich fragrance of cinnamon and fulfillment. The long tapers of cattails are bursting and floating away over the blue shoulders of the ponds. And every pond, no matter what its name, is nameless now. Every year, everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads me back to this. The fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal. To hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends upon it. And when the time comes, to let it go. To let it go. Every year, everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads back to this. The fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal. To hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends upon it. And when the time comes, to let it go. To let it go.